everything in the text up to paragraph 185, through paragraph 185, is the philosopher talking. There's no phenomenology. And therefore, the phenomenology of self-consciousness only begins in paragraph 186. So everything up to then is just talk about it, rather than the phenomenological account of it. Now, if we look hard at paragraph 187, we can, I think, immediately see that Kozhev's thought that there is a battle for recognition, a battle for recognition, a battle for pure prestige is unjustified. What Hegel says is that they engage in a life and death struggle because they must raise their certainty of being for themselves to truth. That is, before the struggle, they're still at the level of self-certainty. That is, they are still at the level of this as an inward conviction. And they need to go beyond that. And he says it is only, this is the very top of page 114, they must engage in this struggle, for they must raise their certainty of being for themselves to truth, both in the case of the other and in their own case. They must raise it to truth both in the case of the other, that is, they must know that the other is a self-conscious being, and they must know that about their own case. And then he says, nothing about recognition here, he says, and it is only through staking one's life that freedom is won. Only thus is it proved that for self-consciousness, its essential being is not just being, not the immediate form in which it appears, not its submergence in the expanse of life, but rather that there is nothing present in it which could not be regarded as a vanishing moment, that it is only pure being for self. So the thought here is that the desire is simply the desire to demonstrate that I am self-consciousness, which is to demonstrate that my point of view on the world is complete or absolute, and that nothing escapes it, and therefore I must, and here's my puzzle, how can I reveal that I am more than a part of this light world of dog-eat-dog, lion-eat-lion, tribe-eat-tribe? That is, I must show that I am more than the desire for life. that the drive for self-preservation does not drive me, I drive it. I want to make the I, so I drive it. And therefore I have to show that my I is in excess of any desire that I may have, and that therefore my life is nothing for me. That is, I must somehow reveal that life is not the standard or norm or criterion, staying alive, that judges me. I have to judge life. And I can only judge life by revealing that I am more than life, and get anyone else who's around to recognize that I am more than life. Now, Kojève, when he sees this moment, thinks that the only thing that goes beyond a given desire is another desire, and that therefore, in order, and this is how he gets his argument going, and that the combatants must therefore be desiring the other's desire. That is, I desire that you desire my desire. Now, and of course, this, Kojève says, is the very definition of love. So, on just right at the very beginning, on page 6, Kojève says, thus, in the relationship between man and woman, for example, desire is human. Is union. Only if one desires not the body, but the desire, if he wants to possess or to assimilate the desire taken as desire. That is to say, if he wants to be desired and loved, or rather recognized in his human value, in his reality as a human individual. Likewise, desire directed toward a natural object is human only to the extent that it is mediated by the desire of another directed toward the same object. And this is what generates his whole view, because he then says, thus an object, perhaps perfectly useless from a biological point of view, such as a metal or a flag, can be desired because it is the object of other desires. Such a desire can only be a human desire and human reality, as distinguished from animal reality, is created only by the action that satisfies desires. And then the great Kojèvian conclusion, human history is the history of desires, desires. Nothing else. Well, what goes wrong with this is that Kojève's argument, although it makes sense and its premise is its premise. That is, the battle is for recognition. And the best refutation of Kojet, I'm sorry it's not on the reading list, it's an essay by Paul Redding called Hermeneutic or Metaphysical Hegelianism, Kojet's Dilemma. And it appeared in the Owl of Minerva, number 22, in 1991, pages 175 to 89. The problem with Kojève's account is that it is circular. The struggle, according to Kojève, is motivated by a distinctly human motive. That is, the desire of the essentially non-vital end of pure prestige. While simultaneously, the struggle is seen as providing the necessary condition for the emergence or birth of the only sort of being that can have that motive. So Kojève wants the battle for recognition to be two things that are incompatible. On the one hand, he wants the battle for recognition to be the emergence of the human, the explanation of how truly human stuff emerges. And on the other hand, he wants it to be an account of something that is already completely human, namely the desire for recognition. So the desire for recognition is playing two roles. It's both explaining the human, and it is constituting of the human. So it's just a straightforward asking to too much. Now, the account that I am suggesting, so on page 192 in Kojève, he says, according to Hegel, man is nothing but desire for recognition. And then he quotes Hegel in German, Mensch ist anerkennen. There's no desire in there. Man is recognition, is Hegel's thesis, not man is desire for recognition, although such a desire does emerge. So for Hegel, the struggle and its institutional outcome is presented as structures of recognition, which I'm claiming, and I agree with Redding here, simply allows the existence of the doubly structured consciousness essential for intentionality. The struggle, as it were, will eventually generate a being, namely the slave, who does desire recognition. And indeed a master who desires recognition. But that's the outcome of the struggle. The struggle itself is not a struggle for recognition, it's a struggle to attain the truth of self-certainty. The struggle is a struggle to attain the truth of self-certainty. That I am the center of the world. And it turns out that is what these beings discover is that they can only achieve that by being recognized. But that's a lesson learned, not the premise of the story. They learn that what they want is recognition. So whereas the struggle itself cannot constitute a stable, enduring, recognitive relationship, the master-slave can. And it represents, as I'll come to in a moment, a minimal institutionalized pattern of mutual recognition, and hence something that can be objectified in spirit, albeit in an inadequate form. So the non-vital end that emerges in the life and death struggle is freedom. And it's now, and it should be intuitive why it must be freedom, right? Because, again, it's self-certainty that's still at stake here until the struggle, the battle ends. And what I, and that freedom is the natural upshot of the desire for absolute independence. That's what they want, absolute independence. I am the world. I am independent of everything. I depend on nothing. That's what draws me into the struggle. And it's therefore that Hegel says that the individual who has not risked his life may well be recognized as a person, but he has not attained to the truth of this recognition. So, it turns out, what's the truth of our this? The truth is that we are the sorts of beings, right, who are self-determining, free, as part of what is meant, must be meant, in us being the center of the world, and that that freedom reveals itself, trying to answer both Adam's question and the other question, that can only reveal itself through the risk of life. That we are non-natural beings. That we actually so this is the ultimate, although possible. So the very notion of being a self-conscious being is being who has a relationship through the world, to the world, through their self-relationship. My self-relationship is what makes me independent of world, but world here is just life. So I must demonstrate for myself and for the other that life is not the highest value. Otherwise I'm just a natural being, just another animal, tiger, whatever. So this is the, so why is this recognizing the truth of personhood? Because to be a person is a status role, not a natural given. To be a person is to have a certain standing with respect to the world, to be able to act in accordance with norms. We'll see all sorts of stuff as you work out. But the first moment in which all that first gets brought to light is the risk of life. And I take it this is why, now going back to this little tribe, like almost all tribes have initiations into manhood that involve the risk of life. Whether it's a walkabout or something else, you actually have to demonstrate that you can be a member of the tribe, that is being capable of living in accordance with norms and values and are not driven merely by desire. The risk of life is the first moment of that. Which is why we all always test ourselves, wonder about it, think about it. I die for? Which is only to ask yourself the question, who am I? Who am I? What do I care about? Do I care about anything? And we think, if we're not going to risk our life, then we're not sure we know what it is to care about anything whatsoever. To have your life as your only need is somehow to be beyond care, to be driven. So there has to be a moment. And Hegel's going to come back to that moment where we have a self-consciousness of ourselves, of the kind of beings for whom life is not the highest good. Now, I can't say everything I need. The question of freedom is not really accessible from this place, but I want to say a couple of words about why Hegel says recognition is about freedom. And here, let me recommend to you an essay by Robert Pippin called "What is the question for which Hegel's theory of recognition is the answer?" And the question is, what is freedom? And Pippin says two things that are relevant to us here. First, he says that, and this is another way of thinking about what's going on in the battle, in the struggle for life and death. What is freedom? And the question is, what conditions must be satisfied such that all my various deeds and projects, all my various doings can be experienced by me as being mine, as my deeds, my projects. And here the issue is, they must be experienced in some way as happening at all because of me. That they're mine because of me and not because I've been given them or have, right? So they require me. Now, this is the case, but if we push this thought too far, and here's the problem with the Fichtean-Kantian line, they think that I can only establish this mindness if I can exempt myself, tear myself out of all my dependencies, all my given roles, all my socialization, all my relationship to nature, and have a moment of absolute spontaneity. That the mindness, called the moral law, is my distance from everything. And that just looks insane. So that model of freedom, that something can be mine, but I'm suggesting that belief, that crazy belief, that something can be mine only if I can exempt myself from all conditionality, from all dependence, from all socialization, is exactly the thought of the being who enters into the battle of life and death. That being wants its mindness, the mindness of everything, to be gotten through the exemption, the denial of all those attachments. Hence, Hegel is going to take a different route. And he's going to take a different route that is surprising, because the route he's going to be taking here is about this intersubjective world, and the intersubjective world can look like a compromise of my will with the will of others. And so, like a partial subjection of my freedom to the freedom of another. And so, freedom as sociality seems contradictory. And Hegel's thought, in opposition to this, is that there could not be anything like an individually free will apart from social challenge and response. That my freedom is a claim, and that it is only in making a claim that is establishing a social relation in which my deeds could be conceived of as truly free. And hence a form of dependence in which independence is achieved. So the thought that this notion of freedom that we're having here, we're beginning with, is problematic because it's part of a fantasy about freedom. That freedom is absolute independence, and that turns out to be the standard definition of freedom. It's the libertarian account of freedom. That freedom is nothing but the freedom from. And Hegel is going to reroot it. Hegel is going to turn freedom into a claim that gets acknowledged or measured against others. Okay. So we have the battle. What next? Well, the very situation of the battle is clearly unsatisfactory. That is, it ain't going to give either combatant what they want. And it's not going to give either combatant what they want, because what they want to know is that they are all of reality. And if they kill the other, then the condition of changing their certainty into truth, that is, having it externally vindicated, externally validated, acknowledged, granted, seen to, disappears. Not only can dead men not wear plaid, but they can't give recognition either. So, Hegel, I want to suggest two things that Hegel is pushing on us here. Both the necessity of the struggle, the battle for life and death, and its necessary failure. It cannot end. in success. It is a bad strategy for attaining the very thing it wants. Now, the battle therefore can only end by a recognition that the risk of life for the sake of making my sense of myself as independent true is self-defeating, because you cannot have self-consciousness without life. Self-consciousness depends on life. So the very thing that it abstracted from, I must risk my life in order to demonstrate my self-consciousness, is the first thing it must reverse itself on, literally. It must say, nope, life is necessary for self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is dependent on a living being. Hence, the thought, secondly, that a combat victory, namely slaying the other, itself does not give me what I want. So the battle can end only if both the future master and the future slave recognize both of these theses, that life is necessary for self-consciousness and a combat victory is not worthwhile since the dead cannot offer validation. The difference between the future master and the future slave is how they weigh these two theses. Those who weigh the first thesis higher, namely that the risk of life for the sake of self-recognition is self-defeating, are going to be the future masters, while those who weigh the second clause higher will be the future slave. That is, the master, they both have to recognize it. Why? Because the master has to let the slave live in order to provide him with acknowledgement, even if he would rather die than be a slave. He nonetheless has to recognize the necessity of life and self-consciousness in order to have a slave. The slave, recognizing the thought that there's no victory to be had here, would rather live to fight another day. So finds the risky no longer worthwhile. Okay, so that gives us the structure of master and slave. And what Hegel now does is give an analysis of each which reveals what is at stake in this. And I remember what I said last week. I take it that this is a
normal
and recurrent form of self-consciousness, which is to say it belongs not to a temporal episode in the past, but it is, as it were, a moment in every self-consciousness that is part of its structure. So it belongs, I suggested last week, to metapsychology. Who is the master? Well, the master, famously, regresses back to animals' desire. The master treats the slave consciously only as a means, as an instrument to satisfy his desires. And I say consciously treats it part of the difficulty in thinking about the master-slave relationship is that it is both conscious and unconscious, or pre-conscious structures. So I'm suggesting that consciously, the master thinks of the slave as mere instrument for satisfying his desires. But unconsciously, the master is recognizing the slave as an intentional human being, for example, because he gives him orders and expects the orders to be understood, etc., etc., etc. So there is both a recognition and non-recognition going on, right? And that some of the recognition and some of what's happening is conscious and some of what's happening is unconscious. So consciously, the master treats the slave as only a means, as an instrument. And secondly, and this is the reason the master is still in a means-ends relationship. And secondly, the master simply consumes the product of the slave's labor. He does not himself gain independence of the object through labor of his own. Hence, in his account, paragraph 190 is a paragraph on the master. He says, the Lord relates himself immediately to the bondsman, through the being that is independent, for it is just this which holds the bondsman in bondage. It is his chain from which he could not break free. Yeah, I wanted to enjoy it. I'll come back to that. I'm sorry. Turn over the page. About five sentences from the bottom. For the Lord, on the other hand, the immediate relation becomes through his mediation, the sheer negation of the thing, or the enjoyment of it. What desire failed to achieve, he succeeds in doing, to have done with the thing altogether, and to achieve satisfaction in the enjoyment of it. Now, what's curious about desire, so no longer, remember the problem with desire, is the object had this independence. But now it doesn't have independence because the slave gives it to him. He doesn't have to worry about whether or not there's water, whether the meat is... No, the slave goes out, right? All the master has to do is enjoy the thing, consume it, without acknowledging its independence. But that means that he is a pure self-identity. 47. He has, and why is Hegel saying this? Not for the mark, although probably like the Marxian reason, you know, the bourgeoisie are just lazy sloths, but it's, well, why is he saying this? Why is he underlining this idea of pure enjoyment? That's going nowhere. It is non-dynamic. It has no developmental potential in it. He is just identity for himself, and all he wants is to stay in that identity, which is why masters are so tyrannical. Secondly, of course, the master is getting his status of mastery from the slave. So he is a master only because he is recognized by the slave as a master, and hence being a master is totally dependent on the other that he does not recognize. So he is recognized by a being that he does not recognize, and therefore he negates the conditions of his own recognition, which is why, so there is something, you know, brutal here. He has nothing but disdain for the very being who gives him his status as master. Now, so the recognition of the master is inadequate because the slave, in accepting slavery, renounced his claim to being an independent self-consciousness. Hence, the recognition of the master is precisely like the coerced confession of a prisoner. We know coerced confessions are hollow. If I twist your arm and I say, tell me I'm beautiful. Tell me I'm beautiful. You're beautiful. Well, I'm going to despise you for saying I'm beautiful. That just shows you're weak. But it also means I'm not so pretty. So there is a dissatisfaction in the master too, because the master is receiving recognition from the being he despises. Now, that said, I just want to point out the obvious, which is this is exactly structurally the master-slave relation is exactly structurally what I said that a structure of recognition would be like. Right? So from one point of view, the master and slave look like one dynamic organism, right? Because the slave does the work of the master, the slave converts the master's desires into actions. I'll come back to this in a moment, since it's the turning point of the story. And therefore, the action of the slave is itself the action of the master. That is the the master says, make me a castle, there's a castle. So it's like the claim is just a prosthesis. Hence, Hegel says, for what the bondsman does is really the action of the Lord. What the slave does is really the action of another. Secondly, therefore, at one level, the institution has to be thought of holistically. Because the roles, master and slave, mutually presuppose one another. Right? To be a master means to have a slave, and to be a slave means is constituted by the other being the master. Hence, the holistic side. However, from the other point of view, the slave cannot be a part of the master. Nor is there any super individual perspective of which the two are mere parts. Rather, the two of them, there is simply the two of them in this relationship. But this relationship is constitutive of them being persons or individuals at all. So there is no single consciousness or point of view which they share. And they mutually presuppose differently embodied and opposing points of view. So, as it were, the structure makes explicit the idea of opposing consciousnesses that exist within a unified structure that is nonetheless nothing more than their relationships to it. So the master has nowhere to go. The slave does. Namely, the slave can become a master. So the slave has something it might or could achieve. Not only that, but his situation as slave is so structured so as to lead him to mastery. For that's what Hegel wants to show. That the very structure of slavery engenders a structure that leads to the desire for mastery. So to say that he desires mastery is to say that he desires the value represented by the master, namely some notion of independence. Well, how is this going to get going? Hegel says, and this is what I want to end with today and want to pick up here next week. So, to say the master is the truth of the slave is to say that, again, the master is both a superego and an ego ideal, as I mentioned in the last one. Now, how this gets going is through the role of death. And it's the role of death that sets the relationship or makes it dynamic. So the question is, I say that I wanted to, in the struggle to overcome all my natural desires, I wanted just to be free of them, and the like. And that strategy did work out. paragraph 194. I'll read this, say a few words about it, and stop. This is Hegel's account of the fear of death. And it's the fear of death that is structuring the life of the slave. And that's what the master is. The master is nothing but a memento mori. For this consciousness, the slave has been fearful, not of this or that particular thing, or just at odd moments, but its whole being has been seized with dread, angst. That's why the slave submitted. In that experience, it has been quite unmanned, has trembled in every fiber of its being, and everything solid and stable has been shaken to its foundation. But this pure universal movement, the absolute melting away of everything stable, is the simple essential nature of self-consciousness. Absolute negativity, pure being for self, which consequently is implicit in this consciousness. This moment of pure being for self is also explicit for the bondsman, for in the Lord it exists for him as his object. Allow me, finally, to overcome my desires, to give them up, to surrender my desires is fear. And the point about fear is that it is a mechanism of detachment from the given. You think you love your children more than anything else. Choose which one will die, or they both die. Sophie's Choice version. All you do is introduce death. And anything that looks solid, looks stable, looks like it's simply a given, becomes surrendered. So the slave is someone who will surrender all his or her given desires, needs, anything, just so long as he or she can stay alive. So, the fear of death is the denaturalization of the self. The fear of death is what rips the individual out of their life world. And it is what sets up the idea of negativity in me. So you're sitting here and you're thinking, I wish you would stop because I have to go to the bathroom. You have an absolute need. But the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So you hold it. So a natural need. So the thought here is you don't know what your desires are. You don't own any of your desires. You don't know what ownness of desires are. You act on
the desire of the Lord.
That's the, so the negativity, he says, is implicit for the slave. It's implicit because the slave is giving up these things, right? So slowly, but he says it's explicit in the object. Why? Because the master is dead. That's what the master means to me. The threat of death. I do the wrong act, I die. That's what it is to be in a master-slave relationship. And hence I have no life that is my own. Hence I have no ownness. So the very notions of mine and own have been lost. But they were anyway just natural mine and own. So we've lost my natural mind and own, and only on the condition of losing my natural mind and own will eventually another mind, a real mind, arise. But first I have to give it up. Well, what desires do I have if not mine? I act on the desires of another. So the slave is the being whose desires are not his desires, but the desires of another. And I make those desires my desire. My Lord wants bread. I desire that there be bread. But I can't claim it. It's not mine. It's the Lord. So my desires are, I internalize the desires of another, and yet the product of that still belongs to me. So this is a process in which I learn of the malleability of all desires, or to put it in another way, and now we're moving to the structure of subconsciousness, I learn that I can stand in a self-conscious that is a reflective relationship to my own desires. That's what I've learned. I've learned that I can evaluate my desires, consider them, and think which ones should I act on and which not. If I diss the guy like this, what will... So I begin to understand that desires are not self-measuring. To have a desire is not to mean it should be satisfied. It means it's something that should be reflectively deliberated on and maybe repressed, deny altogether, or maybe I think I can just... The whole point is I now am in a reflective relationship to myself. Every desire I have now is a question. But the reflective relationship to myself is not a self-relation, just my relation to the other. That is, my self-relation is that mediated relation to the other, demanded by the other being the origins of desire. Okay, it's late. You ought to stop there. I'll pick up with this thought. We will finish master slaving next time. I'll talk about, as I said, the Thai Derrida, and we'll start those.